Are you tired of feeling tired? Do you wish you could turn back the clock on aging? NT-Factor Lipids is the breakthrough supplement that's scientifically proven to repair and renew your body's cells. NT-Factor Lipids are identical to the phospholipids found in your cellular membranes. They've been shown to repair mitochondrial damage, a primary cause of biological aging. In clinical trials, NT-Factor therapy resulted in a 26.8% increase in mitochondrial function, restoring it to levels found in young adults. NT-Factor has also been shown to reduce fatigue by up to 43% and has even been shown to significantly reduce a wide range of symptoms and improve the quality of life in patients with various conditions like chronic fatigue and those undergoing chemotherapy. I've been using NT-Factor for years and prescribe it for my patients. You can find the NT-Factor line of nutritional formulas at your favorite health food store or online retailer. Or, to order direct, call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today, we're going to talk about a book that I have found very compelling because I'm an anthropology major. And as an anthropology major, one of my interests has been, and it's really informed my medical career, has been the evidence from studies of fossil remains and studies of animal primates related to humans about what humans really need to do when it comes to diet, when it comes to lifestyle, when it comes to exercise. What are we suited for from an evolutionary standpoint? I think it was S. Boyd Eaton who coined the phrase, "We are stone agers in the fast lane." That was way back in 1988. He launched the paleo diet revolution. Today we're going to discuss a book that is a really wonderful rundown, not just about the paleo diet, but also about paleo lifestyle and its relevance to our modern lives with a teachable moment for how we can regain our health. Our guest is the co-author of On the Origin of Being: Understanding the Science of Evolution to Enhance Your Quality of Life. She's Jenny Powers. She's an accomplished writer, scientist, and athlete. So she doesn't just talk the talk, she walks the walk. She earned her PhD in microbiology and immunology at the University of Colorado, Denver. She's been a collegiate basketball player, and so she's experienced the benefits of exercise. And she's inspired by the exploration of human nature and the study of our ancestors. So she took on the role of researching and co-authoring On the Origins of Being. And she's also a wife and mom in Colorado. So welcome, Jenny. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. I must say I was so enamored of the book that for our Intelligent Medicine audience, I'm going to write a little book review. So, this is the... you can listen to the audio version, or you can read the book review, or both, but you want to do a deep dive, go to On the Origins of Being. So the first question I have for you is, why the title On the Origin of Being, as opposed to, maybe something like The Real Paleo Diet? It sounds like a very all-encompassing title.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for your interest in our book and for having me on the podcast. It's really interesting because we chose the title mainly because it is paying homage to Charles Darwin on the Origin of Species.
Yes, I felt that resonance, yes.
Yeah. So On the Origin of Being, my co-author, Luke Comer, he is really into nutrition and he's writing another nutrition book. But in all of his studies, he noticed that it's not just nutrition that we're not living in accord with our biology. There are so many other ways of being, right, that we are not living in accord to our biology. So that's kind of how, when he kind of came up with the concept of this book, being is kind of an overarching thing. Like, okay, well, how do we sleep? Well, that's a way that of being. How do we eat? Way of being. How do we work? How do we be with nature? And so I feel like being was a kind of an important word to put in there for our title. And then also, you know, we're talking about our origins and we're talking about evolution. And so all of that kind of tied together.
And the subtitle, of course, news that you can use in your daily life, understanding the science of evolution to enhance your quality of life. So it's like, I mean, it's all very fascinating, you know, we're always interested in, you know, what our Stone Age ancestors were like, but there are practical lessons to be derived. So tell us a little bit about evolutionary biology. How was it that you surveyed the field? Because you actually start by talking about our oldest primate ancestors, you know, maybe 10, 12 million years ago, before even modern primates branched off, like modern chimpanzees and gorillas, you know, maybe a forerunner of humans and modern monkeys.
Yeah. Well, the target of this book, like the overarching theme, is to investigate from our very earliest ancestors. Sometimes in this book, we go back all the way to single-celled organisms, because there are ways of being, such as circadian rhythms, that single-celled organisms developed that we still have today. So we kind of wanted a scientific self-help book where we went over and taught people how to look at evolution, but then also trace our single-celled organisms into multicellular organisms, to mammals, to primates. And then we always start with the human lineage, you know, Australopithecus, Homo erectus, you know, yeah. Right? And then we survived as hunter-gatherers for hundreds of thousands of years. So we spend a lot of time looking at hunter-gatherers, you know, back thousands of years ago. But also there's a lot of studies done on the hunter-gatherers who were lucky enough to exist and survive into the modern world. They are kind of our window. You know, they're not perfect models of our ancestors, but we can start to see trends and really learn a lot from the indigenous people about how, you know, how not only how they live, but how they live in accordance to the biology and how they live in nature, as a part of nature, which I think is a really important
point. I think modern diet enthusiasts tend to appropriate our ancestry to their own ideology. So there are people who were dyed-the-wool vegans who say, hey, look, you know, our primate ancestors, you know, lived in the forest. It was, you know, rich in fruits and vegetables, and we subsisted on that. So why didn't we take a wrong turn and start, you know, killing animals? And then on the other hand, we have this image, and it's kind of like a Fred Flintstone image of, you know, Stone Agers, you know, throwing brontosaurus steaks on the barbecue and being primarily carnivore. I think one of the images that sticks in my head, you know, when I was a kid, is of a, you know, a successful kill by a group of Neanderthals of a mammoth, and they're literally, you know, blood dripping down their chins. They're literally tearing away at the fresh, warm, steaming meat of the animal. And so the carnivore people are saying, no, that is our natural heritage. And I think your book takes a much more nuanced approach to this.
Yeah, I think it's really hard for people these days to understand really what they need to eat to be healthy, because like you said, there are two completely different camps. You know, we're meat eaters. No, we're plant eaters. Well, the reality is when we were evolving, we were a spectrum of eaters. I mean, we lived in the Arctic, and the people in the Arctic ate 95% animal products. We lived in the rainforest. Scarcity of vegetation. Mm-hmm. You know, in the tropical areas in the rainforest, we did eat predominantly more fruit, because wherever we lived, we consumed what nature provided us in that season, whatever was available to us. And so if you think about from the Arctic to the tropics and everywhere in between that our ancestors could have lived, there is this just huge range of potential food based on the season, based on latitude, that we evolve to eat. So I feel like, you know, saying there's only one diet that, you know, everyone needs to follow, that needs a lot more nuance, because we are not all exactly the same. We are going to respond to diet differently. And so what might work for one person might not work for another person. And, you know, the war of diet that's going on, I think, I like to think that, you know, maybe all of these gurus, you know, they can't agree on what to eat, but everybody can agree on what not to eat.
Let's focus on that, because, you know, to talk about this, the scope of human evolution, we're talking not 100,000 years, but hundreds of thousand years, which means maybe several hundred times the time span from the time of the Vikings to our modern era. So multiply that by 100, 200, or 300 years is the time in which our body evolved mm-hmm. in various environments, subject to various environmental challenges, all the while developing bigger brains, upright walking, mm-hmm. The ability to have language and the ability to have culture mm-hmm. that have enabled us as a species to survive under, you know, really challenging conditions.
Yeah. The story, it's really interesting. And I hope the book kind of covers this, but the story of evolution and the story of our nutrition are very intertwined together, because in order to evolve larger brains, we needed to be able to find the nutrition that would allow those brains to be fed properly. So it was kind of like this feedback loop where we needed to find foods. And so not only did, you know, changing environments, but also our changing physiology and the changing needs of our bodies changed what we needed to eat. When we stopped living in the trees and started being more terrestrial, you know, we found more tubers, and we got away from fruit and leaves and things like that. And we found more, tubers.
In terms of nutritional quality, they provide carbohydrates and they provide fiber, but not so much in the way of protein for larger bodies, bigger muscles and brain.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. So, and actually, you know, us starting to eat animal products, we, you know, small mammals, insects, you know, we started small. And as our brains got bigger, you know, we hunted larger and larger animals. And
which requires cooperation, coordination, tool making, language.
Exactly.
All those things. Yeah.
Yeah. And adding those animal
proteins. We're not that strong as animals. You know, we are not T-Rexes. We are not apex predators. So we had to make up for our relative weakness in bodies with ingenuity and cooperation and technology.
Exactly. That's exactly what sets us apart, I think, is our creativity and our intelligence and our ability to actually, we can tackle problems and not have to wait for evolution to help us tackle them. We can use our intelligence to tackle food problems, to tackle, you know, different kinds of problems that might arise.
It has a bit of a downside, because we have, through cultural adaptation, not, you know, gradual natural selection, we've developed a whole new ways of living. We mm-hmm. live in cities. We have modern sanitation. We have incandescent lights at night. We mm-hmm. have food supplies where we can buy all kinds of things just by, you know, ordering from DoorDash. This is much faster than the pace of how animals evolved over time to gradually acclimate to different diets and learn, genetically to mm-hmm. have the capacity to harness the nutrients within foods.
Exactly. So, as we evolved and as we were hunter-gatherers, you know, we started using our intelligence not only to hunt, but also we started cooking our food. We started processing our food. We learned all different ways to mix foods together.
Was less edible and made it more accessible.
Yeah, we needed to start processing our food to get, you know, toxins or to make it more easily chewed. I mean, I think some primates chew for like a third of their lives, but we had more, you know, we have more important things to do. We need to figure out who we can trust and who's a part of our group and how we can, you know, hunt this beast and where we need to go to get water. You know, we had so many other things in our lives that we needed to do that we needed to be able to ingest, chew, and digest and get all the nutrients as fast as we could. So processing became really important. However, when we get to the agricultural revolution and then with the industrial revolution, it really started to exponentially change. Our food dramatically changed. And it was almost like we overshot. Like our intelligence, you know, trying to make this easily digestible, plentiful food, you know, we now started stripping things from the food in order to have refined sugar and refined oils and refined flours. And, oh, these, you know, we need carbohydrates and oil, and let's like put all of these things together to make these fake foods that we never used to eat. So I feel like industrialization, while it, and the agricultural revolution have enabled us to feed so many more people, we feed them much lower quality food. We've processed the heck out of things, and we never used to. We processed food when we were hunter-gatherers, but we still ate the whole food. We ate, you know, we didn't take off the skins. We didn't take out the seeds. We didn't, you know, boil it down and only take the sugar out. We always had the fiber that went along with the fruits and vegetables. You know, we always had the right kinds of fat ratios rather than skewing towards vegetable oil omega-6s. Mm-hmm. And so I really feel like, hopefully, if people realize kind of, you know, we adapted to needing more food as population grew with technology. But at the same time, like you said, our bodies have not adapted. If technology started 100,000 years ago and we started having, you know, all this sugar in our diets, by now, maybe we'd be adapted to eat that much sugar. But, you know, no animal in the history of the world has ever
so speedily changed their physiology to handle an entirely vastly altered food supply. But let's talk about the transition from from Paleolithic to Neolithic, because you do some interesting history there. There are what are called hunter gatherers, and there's still very few hunter-gatherers, pure hunter-gatherers, mm-hmm. who literally are nomadic. They feed off the environment. They capture animals, but they also, gather fruits and vegetables, nuts and tubers. Mm-hmm. This was the way of life up until around maybe 15, 20,000 years ago. And then began mm-hmm. what's called the Neolithic revolution, where suddenly, we had the ability to plant crops, domesticate animals. And in your book, you have an interesting take on that. You actually say that there's a possibility that humans' health took a turn for the worse because of agriculture.
Yeah. I think people have this perception that, agriculture technology is always better. For one thing, we started, gathering together and being in little towns and cities. And so communicable diseases started wiping us out because
so-called zoonoses, because we know that various diseases, smallpox comes from swine, and there's obviously bird flu and so on, and rats transmit mm-hmm. plague and so on, and so these are the kinds of things that are a little more likely to occur in a densely populated area where we have domesticated animals, and then also, the quality of food deteriorated somewhat because we've got these hierarchies where, I guess, the chief of the tribe or the pharaoh of Egypt, got to eat, all kinds of luxurious food. But then the slaves who built the pyramids were fed rations of barley and very little protein, so.
Right.
This took a back seat.
Yeah, it did. The variety and diversity of foods that we ate narrowed significantly. I mean, also the risk of having a famine and wiping out an entire crop and dying of starvation. I mean, our hunter-gatherer ancestors faced challenges like that, but they could move. they could follow the herds. They could go farther south where there might be, you know, better harvesting. And so being stuck where we were, you know, we were stuck with what came out of the harvest. And the lower class people really would only have a diet of one staple that was predominant, and maybe some other little things scattered in.
Yeah, I read a history of, and even in recent times, I read a history of Poland in the, you know, in the, even in the 1600s, 1700s, is that the serfs, you know, the people who were, you know, tended mm-hmm. the land, ate virtually no animal protein. The animals were cultivated for wool, they were cultivated for dairy, but it was the rich people who could eat meat, and it was a real treat to eat meat, you mm-hmm. know, in those days. But suggesting that, you know, prior to that, in the Neolithic times, there was a more diverse diet. But, you know, let's go back to right. the Neolithic times. You know, let's talk about the health problems that people experienced then. Because, I mean, they say that the average life expectancy of somebody in Neolithic times was like, I don't know, 35, 40, 45. They wore out fast. There was a lot of maternal mortality. There was infant mortality. What was different? I mean, and the chronic diseases, yeah, virtually mm-hmm. non-existent, the disease we had, but infectious diseases, maybe, accidents, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I feel like there's several different reasons why our life expectancies went down. So first of all, because women could wean their babies at 1 year and wean them onto cereal, they had more babies. And so there's more of a chance of maternal.
Agricultural food to
this farm. Is an agriculture. Yeah. Yeah. Whereas hunter-gatherers had babies maybe once every 4 or 5 years.
Because they can breast feed that acted mm-hmm. as a birth control for much longer.
Exactly. And then there was the nutritional, just the lack of nutrition, the lack of the macronutrients that you needed, you know, the fats and proteins, and the lack of micronutrients, you know, a lot of vitamin deficiencies, a lot of mineral deficiencies, just because we had nothing to choose from except barley or, you know, bread and, you know, a little bit of meat or protein here when it was a special occasion, like you said. But then also it changed our society because now when we planted crops and had to wait 8 months to harvest, now we needed to protect our land, right? So it changed from, you know, nobody owns any land. We're just kind of all walking around, you know, finding what we need to. We own this land and we're going to fight you for it. So mm-hmm. the conflict, societal conflict increased dramatically as well on the onset of the agricultural revolution. So I really feel like there were just lots of different nutritional, cultural, biological, you know, with the maternal death ways that our quality of life went way down.
Right. And there was some studies that came out where they looked at mummified remains and they said, oh, you know, they wanted to make the point that atherosclerosis is not a modern scourge, that it was there in the time of the pharaohs. But I looked at that evidence and I thought, hey, you know, the people who were mummified, you know, and well-preserved, they could afford to go through that very, very technical process where their remains were preserved, were probably wealthy folks who could kind of eat high on the hog. And what about the rest of the folks who probably on a much more scanty diet, they probably didn't. Is there any data on the degree to which there's heart disease among modern hunter-gatherers?
It's virtually non-existent.
Okay.
Diabetes. Yeah, in fact, it's a really interesting study when a hunter-gatherer group becomes colonized or that they're forced to move off their land and forced to eat a different diet. The rates of type 2 diabetes and heart disease just skyrocket because they are not, you know, people who've had 12,000 years of this, you know, might not be so susceptible resilient to some of these things. Yeah. And so I think there's the Pima people in the Southwest. I think they now have like an 80% it's in the book. Don't quote me on it. Look in the book. Maybe 80% of their people by the time that they're 50 have type 2 diabetes.
Very high percentage. And in fact, this, I was just, yeah, you know, prior to jumping on this podcast with you, I was listening to a fascinating Senate hearing that was under the auspices of Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, where he invited Casey and Kelly Means, and he invited RFK Jr., and a variety of spokespersons to talk about the dismal state of health in America. And one of the speakers cited the terrible statistics of the Pima Indians, who, you know, lived in a very harsh, challenging environment for thousands of years, and within a generation became sick and, you know, suffered very high rates of diabetes. You know, it's almost ubiquitous among them. And this is really kind of evidence of the pernicious effects of modern life.
They're just set on fast forward. You know, they went through that in a generation, whereas, you know, most other modern people have gone through it for thousands and thousands of years. So they're just like doing in a very small, short time frame. It's like they go through our entire existence and how we got to where we are today with these humongous percentages of people with these diseases of modernity. So these are the non-communicable diseases. Heart disease, diabetes, cancer, obesity. There are all of these. And what's interesting, so these are the diseases of modernity. But what's interesting is these diseases hit people after, pretty much, they're hitting younger and younger people. But for a while, it was hitting people after their reproductive years.
Natural selection is not operating here.
Exactly.
Because we are basically perpetrating, you know, or perpetuating these problems. And, you know, actually, I read an interesting column recently from a doctor who said that we're actually creating a new species. Instead of Homo sapiens, we're creating a species called Homo fragilis or Homo infirmus. You know, in other words, a population of fragile, chronically ill people. You know, facetiously, he's saying that.
Right.
You know, this seems to be the case.
Our lifespans are actually decreasing. For like one of the first times in history, our lifespan is decreasing. But what's decreasing even more is our health span.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's the time that you live without any of these diseases, where you can, you know, live a generally healthy, well-adjusted, you know, life in homeostasis with your environment. But now, you know, 65 years old start getting these chronic diseases, and modern medicine is wonderful at keeping them alive longer, but their quality of life is forever altered.
Indeed. And also, I mean, I'll say at a great cost to society.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the need for extraordinary medical expenditures. We're just not getting bang for our buck. You know, we're coming up with better drugs, treatment, surgeries, breakthroughs that may tank our GDP. Okay, so.
Yeah, well, and also,
go ahead.
I just wanted to say all of those interventions aren't treating the root cause anyway.
Exactly.
So they're just like putting a Band-Aid on it and, like I said, keeping you alive longer. Whereas, you know, what you do, functional medicine, integrative medicine, I really hope that that's the way of the future, because you really need to stop these diseases before they start. You know, people need to have their health in these areas addressed when they're younger, so they understand that their habits now are going to affect them later. What they're eating now is going to affect them 30 years from now. How they're sleeping, you know, how they're working, you know, 80-hour weeks, it's all going to affect them later. And they're going to wish they had known better earlier.
Right. And that's the theme of the book. The book is on the origin of being, understanding the science of evolution to enhance your quality of life. And we want to talk more about some specifics about what our ancestors ate, how we came to learn about it, what are some of the take-home messages, and we'll also talk about some other aspects of our lifestyles where we can learn from our ancestors, because there's some very interesting lessons to be applied. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest is Jenny Powers, co-author of On the Origin of Being, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. We'll be right back.